Welcome to All Together Now. This is Eleanor LaCane. Our guest today is Jean Faraca, an award-winning journalist, writer, and public speaker, widely respected as Wisconsin Public Radio's premier talk show host. For 13 years, Faraca hosted Conversations with Jean Faraca. She then created another successful program that she hosted for 10 years called Here on Earth, Radio Without Borders, the pioneer international news and cultural affairs talk show. During her influential career, she earned major awards from many groups, including the National Alliance on Mental Illness, the National Telemedia Council, and Ohio State, as well as a Gabriel Award for her signature series, Women of Spirit, and a second Gabriel Award for Inside Islam, Dialogues and Debates. She is the author of 3 books of poetry and her award-winning memoir, I Hear Voices, a memoir of life, death, and the radio. In 2003, she co-founded the Odyssey Project at the University of Wisconsin, an educational experiment designed to transform the lives of adults living in poverty. Now in its 13th year, she teaches philosophy and civic engagement as one of Odyssey's core faculty. She also teaches Plato in prison. I was an occasional guest on Jean's fabulous radio show talking about political analysis and breakthrough solutions. This is the first time we've spoken in many years. Jean Faraca, welcome to All Together Now.
Oh, Eleanor, it's wonderful to hear your voice again. It brings back so many memories.
Yeah, it really does, and it's so great. You pointed out how funny it is to have this role reversal.
But right.
I'm so excited to be able to have this conversation with you again on the air.
Well, this is the first time I've been on this side of the console, so to speak.
Oh, fun. Well, I want to start off because in 2012, you retired after nearly 30 years on Wisconsin Public Radio, and you were just fabulous, like the best radio talk show host I know. And at the time you retired, you thought you were going to focus on writing, cooking, traveling, language, and getting to know your grandchild. Yet for the past 3 years, you've been involved in the Prison Ministry Project, teaching prisoners. So,
well, I've managed to do
happened?
All those other things as well, except that my son whisked my granddaughter away several times. The first year of her life, she was living in Florence, and then she lived in Montreal. And this past year, she's been back in Florence. And so it's been a little difficult for me to stay that connected to grandmotherhood. You know, it's a wonderful life, really.
Yeah, it sounds great. And I'm curious, with your total freedom to do anything in the world that you want to do, why did you decide to teach prisoners?
You know, it's not a question of decision. The path opens and beckons, if you'll excuse my using that term. The opportunity presents itself, and then it's really difficult to say no. It grew very organically out of my work with Odyssey, where I've been teaching Greek philosophy the first semester. Now we just finished our 14th year, so it's a very well-established program and was always very rewarding and very exciting. And then when this came along, one of our alumnus, if I can use this singular, came to my church and gave a little presentation on Moses, which is an organization here in Dane County in Wisconsin that works on criminal justice reform. And I was so inspired by his presentation that I said to him, James, what can I do to get involved in this? And so he really led the way. And through him, I met Jerry Hancock, who is a congregational minister and the head of the Prison Ministry Project. And he gave me an opportunity to get involved in restorative justice. So that was my first step. And after a couple of rounds of restorative justice, I thought to myself, gee whiz, you know, this is really great, but I think I'd like to try an experiment. And he paved the way for my introducing an extract from the Odyssey curriculum in a program that he helped me work on in a very special prison here in Wisconsin. It's under the aegis of not the Department of Corrections, but the Department of Health. And that really makes a very different story because it's really a treatment facility. And it's for men who are in need of mental health facilities and services. And so it was a very different kind of setting. The staff was involved. It was very welcoming. And it worked so brilliantly that I decided to try it in another setting. And the second time I did it, first time we had 15 students. The second time I had 40. And I'll never forget walking into that chapel. That's where the class was held, in a chapel. And it was in August, and there was no air conditioning. And there were these great big fans roaring away. And I'm very hard of hearing now. So it was very challenging. But we got through it. And again, it was very, very exciting results. And I think for me, what has been most rewarding has been this sense of really deep connection with the men themselves and coming to understand who is in prison and why are they there and what kind of potential do they have, and to offer them resources that I myself have made great use of in my own life has been, it's been a great gift. You know, it's like you read a great book and you almost feel compelled to pass it along.
Right.
Well, that's the way I feel about the humanities. And actually, this whole program, the Odyssey, was based on something that a man named Earl Shores started on the Lower East Side in Manhattan and wrote about in Harper's Magazine in an article that really changed my life in the September 1997 issue of the magazine, in which he described what happened when he brought together his poker buddies, and they started this experiment in giving very high-level humanities classes to people who had probably never even finished high school, and what happened as a result to all of them, teachers included. So I was very inspired by that. And as a matter of fact, I can tell you exactly the passage in the article that was the inspiration, the initial, the kernel that blossomed in my life. It was,
well,
this
I want to hear it, because I do want to hear that. And I just want to make a note here, just for all those writers who are out there listening, to realize how significant what you say, possibly whether in writing or sometimes it's in person, but what you say can change a life. And when you change that life, you can change many lives and a ripple effect through that. So I want to hear this passage that changed your life.
Okay. This is a telephone conversation. Earl Shores, the late Earl Shores, who won the Humanities Medal from President Clinton for his work, for this work with poverty, he got this call on a Saturday morning from one of his students. And he thought, uh-oh, this is the call from jail. And so he hears, Mr. Howell? Yes. How you doing? No, wait a minute. I started off wrong. Mr. Howell is what the student called Earl Shores. He never got his name straight.
Uh-huh.
How you doing, Mr. Shores? I'm fine. How are you? I had a little problem at work. Uh-oh, I thought. Bad news was coming. David is a big man, generally good-humored, but with a quick temper. According to his mother, he had a history of violent behavior. In the classroom, he had been one of the best students, a steady man, 24 years old, who always did the reading assignments and who often made interesting connections between the humanities and daily life. What happened? Mr. Shores, there's a woman at my job. She said some things to me, and I said some things to her. And she told my supervisor I had said things to her, and he called me in about it. He's 40 years old, and he don't have no social life. And I have a good social life, and he's jealous of me. And then what happened? The tone of his voice and the timing of his call did not portend good news. Mr. Shores, he made me so mad, I wanted to smack him up against the wall. I tried to talk to some friends to calm myself down a little, but nobody was around. And what did you do? I asked, fearing this was his one telephone call from the city jail. Mr. Shores, I asked myself, what would Socrates do?
Oh, beautiful. Amazing.
I know. I read that and I thought, oh, wow. Because I've been through very difficult times in my life. And I swear it was my foundation in the values that I learned in my liberal arts education, and particularly in Greek philosophy and in poetry, that kept me going and got me through.
Uh-huh.
And that was the whole premise on which Earl Shores began his Clemente course. That's what he calls it, the Clemente course. It's still going strong. It's in it's a college in upstate New York. Anyway, I just felt compelled to, first of all, have him on my program. And then I met him in Chicago, where he was in the process of starting yet another Clemente course through the Illinois Humanities Council. And again, meeting the man, he was just short, a little bullet of a man, very powerful, very persuasive. And I just said, I'm going to do this. I'm going to start this in Madison. Fortunately, he came to Madison. He gave a presentation, and in the audience was a professor of continuing education and of literature whose own parents were products of Berea College. Her mother was the first woman to go to college in her family, and she went with one skirt and two blouses. She met her future husband there, who was a refugee from the Holocaust and the token Jew in Berea. Berea's in Kentucky. And so she was inspired and knew how important the humanities were and how they had lifted up her whole family. So she became the director. And that's how it all got going.
That is an amazing story, and I love that you read that passage and took it in so deeply and then followed up and had him on your show and met him in person and then brought him there to speak. I mean, what an incredible chain. So tell our listeners a little bit about the Odyssey Project itself. Like, what came from that whole experience? And I should say you had suggested looking into the Odyssey Project. I read, I saw a documentary about it on YouTube.
You did.
Which
you watched the documentary. Yeah, that really tells the story very well.
Yeah, and I highly recommend it to our listeners to go to YouTube and look for the Odyssey Project by documentary by Forward Motion. But tell us now here, what came of that? What kind of a educational program did you create based on the model of the fellow in New York?
Well, the humanities, American history, taught by Craig Werner, who is the chair of the African-American Studies Department here at the UW. he does the history. Emily Auerbach, who is the director, does the literature. We have a man named Marshall Cook, who teaches writing. Very important skill for this kind of population to acquire. These are return students, many of them from deep poverty. And, you know, they fall through the cracks if you don't have a system to shore them up when this happens. And that's one of the geniuses of the program, because we have daycare, we have slush funds in case somebody gets evicted, in case somebody gets sick or a child gets sick. Anyway, I didn't finish. I teach Greek philosophy, and the anomaly of teaching Walt Whitman in the spring, because I happen to love Whitman and Emily doesn't. So that's how that got going. And let's see, what am I leaving out? Literature, philosophy, art history. And again, the chair of the art history department and the head of the Chazen Museum teaches the art history. And a final project in the art history component is to make a self-portrait. And that's really an amazing thing, what these students come up with. And they range, you know, from all ages, as young as 18, and we had one woman who was 76 when she completed the program. And in recent years, we've had a lot of immigrants, some from Africa, some from the Caribbean. As a matter of fact, just the other night, my husband and I were walking by Lake Wingrove, which is just a block away from where we live, and who should I bump into but a Syrian refugee who just completed the program this past year. And he has an incredible story, because when the Great Purge came and we thought we were going to lose him, he had to go down to Chicago and prove that he has asylum status. And he's a wonderful young man who was tortured in Syria. Mm. He has the marks to show it. And he did get asylum status. When he was in Syria, he was about to complete his dentistry program. And so now he has just been accepted at the University of Wisconsin, and he's going to begin all over again his dentistry program. And he's a delightful young man. As a matter of fact, my husband has Syrian ancestry, and the two of them went on and on and on about their favorite Syrian foods.
Well, it's so impressive. And so these are the students that you're teaching in the Odyssey Project. These are people kind of down on their luck, maybe into many generations of poverty. Some of them are actually homeless and living in shelters. And they've had really a lot of hard knocks in life. And yet you've helped create this learning project for them. They come in, a one-year program, and they do really challenging work in the humanities. I mean, you're talking about going deeply into Walt Whitman, going into, you know, Socrates and Plato. It's just a real immersion, kind of a college preparatory course, and that the students in it do so well and get so engaged in the material, and it just flies in the face of all the misimpressions people have that people who are poor, people who are homeless, don't really have an interest or don't have the ability to understand or engage with the humanities at that level. But what you're showing is, yes, they do, and present the material in an interesting and compelling way, and you can engage people deeply in their lives.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, Socrates was right when he said that the unexamined life is not worth living. Uh-huh. And they understand that. They uh-huh. get it. And they're raring to go in spite of all the challenges, and they have many challenges. But as Emily puts it, just to walk through that door every week is an achievement. Uh-huh. And we have now, I don't know what the numbers are exactly, but several of our graduates have gone on to get professional degrees. And it's not just individuals. This is what's so interesting. It's whole families that are lifted up. And as a matter of fact, you know, once the kids see their parents doing homework, it's a marvelous example that they set, and the kids want to get involved too. And Emily, in her endless ambition for the program, started 2 years ago an Odyssey Junior, and so now we have kids, beginning with preschoolers, on up to the age of 18 when they're actually eligible for the program, who are all involved every week. Instead of just going to daycare, they're being enriched and they're getting it, you know. And so that's very exciting.
That's amazing. I love that you're doing this. And we see from this whole thing, you know, we hear about that education is the doorway to a better life. But if you ever needed any example or evidence that that is true, your program, the Odyssey Project in Madison, Wisconsin, just absolutely shows how true that is. And that inside all of us is this hunger to learn.
Is this what?
The hunger to learn.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. You know, one of the ironies in all of this is that, well, the way Earl began, he used to say in his first class, I'm going to give you what the Rockefellers got, meaning the enrichment of the humanities. But the irony is they have since disappeared. The humanities have disappeared from the college curriculum. And there's so much emphasis these days on utilitarian learning, learning to get a degree that you could then use to make a living. Now, I'm not saying that's not important, especially with the cost of higher education these days, but we are still holding out, you know, the torch for learning for its own sake.
Mm-hmm.
And learning, I mean, this is what inspires me when I work in the prisons, is nobody can take this away from you. Once you get it, you can free yourself in place.
That's beautiful.
That's what I believe.
Mm-hmm. That's awesome. Now, tell us a little bit about what you're teaching here. You mentioned Greek philosophy. So you're teaching both to the students in the Odyssey Project and then more recently with some of the men in prison. You're talking Greek philosophy. You're talking Socrates and Plato. How is that relevant to the lives of these people who may be homeless or in prison?
Well, just imagine. The allegory of the cave, which is where I start with both groups, the Odyssey Project and now in prison, Socrates tells about this image, or this, well, the allegory is a metaphor for the universal human condition. He says, imagine men, you know, shackled. They cannot move their heads in a cave. They're looking at a wall on which they see only shadows. The shadows come from a fire that's behind them and also from a platform, a raised platform, like a kind of stage, along which actors carry statues of things, all kinds of things that represent the stuff of the world. And all of this stuff is thrown on the wall by the light from the fire, and that's all they can see. So that they think the shadows, they take the shadows to be reality. And once one prisoner is freed and stands up and begins the long ascent out of the cave, he must experience a lot of pain. First, the physical pain from having been cramped and kept in one position all his life, and then the sight, the problem of the light blinding him, and then the psychological pain of realizing he's been disabused. He's been subject to what he thought was real was actually an illusion. And in order to break away from the illusion, he has to acknowledge that he was a fool. And that's very difficult. It's very difficult for all of us, obviously. But you can see the relevance. First of all, these are prisoners that I'm teaching.
In a cave. They're in a cave, literally.
Oh, absolutely. So the first assignment I give is, tell us about your cave. What was the cave you were born into that led you to this cave? And that's kind of easy for them.
Mm-hmm.
The next question I pose is, tell us about a belief or a set of beliefs that you cherished, that you held dear, that you had to give up because you eventually saw through it. And, you know, a lot of them come from gangs. A lot of them come from Chicago. And they're born into the ghetto, and then they get drafted into gangs. And some of them become enamored of the leadership of the gang or the leader of the gang. Some of them become the leader of the gang. And, you know, they think they're big shots. And then they end up in prison. And the whole lifestyle gets exposed for what it really is. And this is painful. So, and there are endless relevances. And they get it. They don't have to be persuaded that this is their story. They understand it right away. And then this process of reflection that they go through is transformative. It's illuminating. And it gives them a tool, the tool of reason, the tool of reflection. That's what Earl's big point was. These people, by and large, are born into a surround of force. That was his term, a surround of force. And all they know is how to react to it. But through reason, like the guy David, he could penetrate that surround of force and break through it using reason rather than reaction.
Oh, my God, I so want Donald Trump to take your course. If he could just break through his cave and through reason get to the other side, but I know that's just another one. That's my own wish of the day.
Your fantasy, Eleanor.
My fantasy. But just think, really, how many millions of people, like everybody, could learn from this, what you're talking about? Because we all have a cave of some sort. We all have illusions that we think are reality. And then, but to discover that they are illusions and to let them go and to be able to focus on what's really happening, it takes courage.
Yeah, and sometimes I'm married to a biochemistry professor, and he's taught me a lot about the scientific process and how, you know, you have to set up a hypothesis, and then the whole process is to disprove it. And that can be very painful. You get very attached to your hypothesis. And once you discover evidence that proves it or disproves it, you have to let it go. Hopefully you arrive at truth by being willing to go through this again and again and again. And that's the point that Socrates makes. This is not a one-time thing. You have to be prepared to keep doing it through your whole life, really. And then he makes a very important point, because this is from The Republic. The allegory of the cave is an excerpt from Plato's Republic. And Plato wrote The Republic because he was so disillusioned by living in Athens, which was supposed to be the greatest city-state, you know, in the world. But they put Socrates to death. They put him on trial. And he was put to death. And this was Plato's beloved teacher. And he was thrown into trauma as a result of having lived through this. And he left Athens and wandered for many years. But then he came back and set up the first university, the first academy, and began teaching Socrates, because that was his way of bringing him back to life and preserving for all of us the wisdom that was contained in his teaching.
Incredible story. So here you are, you're teaching Plato's Republic to both the students in the Odyssey Project, kind of the adults in poverty and Madison, as well as the men who are in prison, and getting this phenomenal response of how much they can relate to it. And in the Odyssey program, not only are they learning about Socrates, they're reading Shakespeare, they're reading the Constitution, they're reading the Federalist Papers, they're reading Walt Whitman. It's basically a free college course in the humanities. And it's a one-year program. And after that program, first of all, it looks like you have a very high success rate, that you know, virtually all of the students who are in that program graduate from the program and pass the rigorous academics. Is that right? Do you have that high of a success rate?
Well, that's really due to Emily, because she just won't let anybody. She's like a mother hen. She won't let anybody get lost. I remember vividly one time when one of our students ended up in jail, and she just brought him his homework. And
no escaping the homework assignment.
I mean, she'll track you down.
That's
She's
great.
She's just determined that way. And there have been other similar programs that have started on the model of Earl's program, but I don't think any of them have been as successful as much of the time as ours, and it's really due to Emily. Mm-hmm. And also the fact that we do have this slush fund, that when something breaks down, we can break it through and save people from having to leave. You know, very, very seldom do we lose anybody. It does happen, but rarely.
Right, and that should be considered part of the financing required for this program to successfully function, as you need to have some funds available for some unexpected things that you may not know exactly what's going to happen, but you know these folks are facing a lot of challenges in their lives, and you know maybe you need to make sure that everybody's eating a good meal before the class begins or something like that.
Well, exactly. We do feed our students every week, every Wednesday. There's a meal waiting for them. That's the first thing that happens. And that's enormously important.
Yeah. And then you have some of these students who have come through. For many of them, the Odyssey Project is a one-year program that's a gateway into college, into the University of Wisconsin at Madison. So do you know about how many of the students really move forward from the Odyssey Project into actually being college students?
Well, I don't have statistics at hand, but I can tell you that the normal pattern is when they graduate, they'll often go on to MATC, Madison Technical College, and then they're tracked. And if they do well there, they go to the UW. And we even have a few now who have gotten advanced degrees. We have one who's a lawyer. I told you the story of Ahmad, who's going to pursue dentistry. We have some professional degrees. But, you know, it's not so much, at least I think, it's not so much how many of them succeed in finishing advanced courses, but how do they feel about themselves?
Uh-huh.
How are they parenting their children? What are their aspirations and expectations about life? What evidence do we have of their civic engagement? Are they voting? Are they involved in social justice? Are they helping one another? To me, that's the most important measure of success. And it was for Earl as well, because he talked about what happened to David Howell when he graduated. He set up a program in his own neighborhood for single mothers. And that was his measure of success. And Socrates makes the same point in the allegory of the cave. He says, once you have made the ascent to the light, which is the ascent of the soul, you can't just enjoy enlightenment.
Mm-hmm.
You've got to go back. You have to go back to your fellow prisoners and tell them what it's like back up there. And don't expect that they're going to welcome you either, because they might even try to kill you, he says. And he also makes the point, and I love this, that it's the reluctant leader who makes the best leader, the one who's not is not dazzled by power for its own sake.
Fantastic. I love that. And what an interesting measure of success. And I do think there's been way too much emphasis put in our educational system over the past decades on trying to track students, you know, into college. So we now have roughly about 25%, I believe, of the American population have gone to college. But a lot of those college graduates now can't get jobs. So they're there with their college degree and serving as a barista at Starbucks or, you know, some place where they're not feeling very fulfilled or don't have much of a prospect for advancing. Meanwhile, we have a desperate need for people who are skilled plumbers and electricians and people who can fix our washing machines and our dishwashers, and that takes a lot of smarts to be able to do those trades. So I think we kind of did ourselves a disservice in some ways about pushing this whole thing about a college degree, but there's lots of different ways of getting an education, and I love your focus on kind of the humanities and measuring success by how people feel about themselves, how they are as parents, how they are as citizens, how they are as members of the community, fighting for social justice. So hats off to you for that that whole approach to education of the whole person.
Well, you know, I do want to make the point that for Earl, it was very important that this be an academic program, because he said, usually what the poor are offered is vocational training.
Right.
Job training, not ideas. He wanted them to understand the power of ideas, the transformative power of ideas. And that's what I'm committed to, because, you know, I'm not a plumber.
Right. That's not what you bring to the table.
I'm mechanically challenged.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad you said that, too, because I interviewed Deborah Meyer, who is the founder of a great program in high school in Harlem, where 90% of the students graduate and go to college, Central Park East in Harlem. And when she wrote a book about her whole experience of how do you educate people who come from families of poverty and crime and communities with a lot of violence and concerns and get them to engage enough academically to be able to go on and go to college and graduate from college, she called the book The Power of Their Ideas. And her whole approach was to find that spark inside each person where they were curious and wanted to learn, had an interest, and then really engage them and develop that and develop the person and develop their ability to be asking questions and analyzing and understanding. So it sounds like you've got kind of a similar view here.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, we want the best for ourselves. So why shouldn't everybody be offered the best? I mean, I remember, Eleanor, you used to say that the purpose of government is to help people achieve their potential.
Yes, to create the social conditions that enable each person to identify and develop their full potential.
Yeah, and you didn't make distinctions. You didn't say this was only for people with higher education degrees or people who come from a higher income bracket. You meant it as a deeply held democratic principle.
Yes. And we can still do that.
Oh, please, let's do it.
Yeah, I'm working on a piece right now called Common Sense, which is kind of like what Thomas Paine wrote in the American Revolution about why the colonies needed to break free of Britain. And it kind of laid out why it was common sense to follow that path and what it would look like and how it would work. So I'm now writing a common sense for the United States today. Mm. And it's getting beyond what I see as kind of the ideological exhaustion of the right and even the left in many ways, that a lot of the Democratic Party, the Republican Party have kind of spun out and gone down a rabbit hole. So the question is, what can we do now that will help uplift the people of the United States? And it's very much on this premise that you're talking about, that let's look at the role of government at helping people to find and fulfill their life purpose and their best ability. And there's no reason why, just because you're born in a poor neighborhood in Madison, that you shouldn't have the opportunity to learn Plato or learn like what you're talking about, you know, get excited about ideas and philosophy, as well as if you want a trade and if you want a college degree, but whatever it is that's going to help you develop your potential as a human being. So I'm going to be mapping out kind of an action agenda for America of how do we take America back from the dark money, from the Russian interference in our elections, and what's the program of action that we could have the government follow that would really help the American dream refresh and be real for all of us today?
Well, I hope you don't forget the importance of, I mean, you're talking about common sense. I think the thing that's missing, that's absent from our cultural landscape is the commons. And what I hear from Odyssey students and from what I hear even from men in prison who go through this program is how much they have come to appreciate the experience of being in community.
Mm-hmm. Amen, sister. I think it is probably the key to why you and Emily are so successful in your Odyssey project, and also the work you're doing with the men in prison, is about creating a sense of community and a real deep sharing and connectedness. And that's really, that's what Deborah Meyer does in her schools, is to really, it's about building the school community. And I believe it's the community that creates the context for the individual to thrive.
Yeah, and we've forgotten that. We've lost our sense of it. We're atomized, you know, and we've brought the whole wonderful concept of individualism too far. We've lost our sense of who we are as a people and who we are together, and that's a darn shame. It's hard to get back once you've lost it.
Yeah. But I do believe people crave community, and when you create a safe space like you have in the Odyssey Project or in your prison program, that people will actually share in a way. I think people yearn for community. So if we can create that in our schools and in our neighborhoods and even to some extent in our workplaces and our government agencies, be creating a community that honors and respects each person that's there and what they bring to the table, that's really how we're going to move forward. It's
well,
not
how
about...
do we get back to that, Eleanor? Do you have any ideas?
Well, I think you begin by not believing that one man on a white horse is going to come in and rescue us and fix everything, even if he says he will. So we need to kind of let go of that fantasy.
Well, we've had that fantasy now with two administrations, because we certainly projected that on to Obama.
Right.
And now, you know, Trump, of course, anointed himself
right.
as the man on the white horse. And
right, exactly. Trust me, I'll fix it all for you. It's just not possible, is number one. And number two, it's not even advisable because really the best is when we kind of come and work together. Yes, I do think there are ways that we can systematically build community. I think, like everything, my whole focus is on look at who's done it successfully and build on what works. That's my whole book on Breakthrough Solutions. Who's done this well? Who builds community well in this context? And learn from that and do it. I think your Odyssey Project is a great model, from what I know of it, of building a community that helps people learn and grow. I think having more women in government would be a really good thing, electing women at the local, state, and federal level. And I'm hoping in 2018 that there's a big wave of, you know, new people showing up and throwing their hat in the ring and being willing to engage and get involved in governance. So I think there's many ways we can do it, both in and out of government. So it's entirely possible. Part of it is being clear that's what we need. And I believe there's always been the two strains in the American character and culture. There is the strain of the rugged individual, and that's the Wild West cowboy and the shootout at the OK Corral where the sheriff comes to mow down the bad guys. You know, there is that rugged individualism. But at the same time, throughout the American history and character has been this communitarian kind of spirit. If you go back to the Massachusetts Bay Colony, for example, mm-hmm. when they were on the Mayflower and just coming to, as they were crossing the Atlantic Ocean to arrive in Massachusetts to set up the Massachusetts Bay Colony, they put together the Mayflower Compact, which laid out the terms of that community and how they would live together when they landed. And there's some incredible principles in there about no one will have excess as long as anybody has need. And at the same time, everybody needs to work and to contribute in whatever way they can contribute. And I think some of those core principles from the Massachusetts Bay Colony actually have consistently run through the American story and the American character. I think we need to have a much more balanced view of having the rugged individual functioning within kind of a more community-oriented society and bring some of those principles back to the fore.
That's very interesting. I know you spent a lot of time in Boston. I'm glad you imbibed those ideas and principles. You know what I draw a lot of inspiration from is Jerry Brown, who, you know, decided he was going to do, forget about the feds. They weren't going to do anything on climate control, climate change. So he was going to connect with the wider world. Conceive of something that would work in California with a global community of kindred spirits who understand the vitality, the understand that we are at a critical impasse and absolutely need one another to figure all this out. I mean, we're going through a very dark time, and to pull back from the world, to pull back from who's out there, who can help. You know, how do we solve this thing? We can't do it alone. We have to do it together.
Absolutely. I think that is absolutely true. And not only is it Jerry Brown, who I have a lot of respect for, and now as governor of California, he is still committing to the Paris Accords on climate change. There are many governors, the governor of New York, the governor of Massachusetts, even a Republican governor, Charlie Baker, has also agreed to abide by the Paris Accord on climate change. So the governors are getting together, and also the mayors of the world are in a big way coming together and saying, we're going to abide by the Paris Accord no matter what the President of the United States might say or do. So I think what you're seeing is the kind of limits of the regal power of the presidency, that if there's the power of the people at the local and state level, both in government and out of government, going ahead and doing what needs to be done, even if you've got someone trying to clog up the works at the top of the political food chain, that the governors and the mayors are undaunted. There is an incredible network and community of mayors across the U.S. and around the world that are still very active and very committed to making progress on climate change. So I think we have some of the communities we need emerging, and of course the women's community, which mobilized big time right the day after the inauguration of the new president, just with 3 million people worldwide marching in the streets, perhaps the largest gathering and demonstration in the history of the world, that it is a dark time and the women are stepping up and going, we don't like the way this is going. We're not going to be pushed back. We will stand for the advancement of women. We'll stand for equality. We're not going to let ourselves or anybody else be pushed backward. So I think there's some amazing communities already formed and active out there.
Mm-hmm. And if I might, I want to, if I may, bring this back to who's in prison.
Yes.
Because they're Americans too.
Right.
And they have so much to offer. I am sitting here at my kitchen table, and in front of me is the most extraordinary gift I have ever received. And it was given to me anonymously by the last class I taught. I wish I had a picture, but let me try to do it in words. This is a long, narrow box. It's made out of cardboard, and it's sealed with tape because these are the materials that they have. And on the cover is a chevron, sort of a with beautiful blue feathers. And it's tied together, this box, with two pieces of sinew. You open it up, and inside is the most exquisite dream catcher.
Oh.
And it is made, again, out of these beautiful blue feathers, a few beads, rawhide. It is so delicate and so beautiful. I keep it in its box. And in the, when it was presented to me, it came with a little note that says, "This dream catcher is for Jean Faraca. She and her brother have experienced a deep appreciation for the Native culture. Just donate it from the group to her as a sign of our appreciation. Thanks." The delicacy and the sensitivity that this gift manifests comes from men who have committed terrible crimes, and it speaks to me so eloquently, so movingly, of what they're capable of and who they truly are. They have made the ascent of the soul, and this is its manifestation.
That's awesome. And I love what you started with there about how these prisoners are Americans too. I mean, they are human beings. They're people. They are part of our American family. And we now have over 2 million people in prison. So we need to figure out a whole other way of dealing with this a crime situation, prison situation, that actually helps people become more productive members of our society. The whole way we're doing criminal justice right now is just kind of, it's not really working. They get these 2 million people in prison, paying about $74 billion a year, and then when they come out of prison, they often will commit a crime and come back with a high rate of recidivism. So we need to do it very differently. And that's part of what I love about the program that you're doing, both the Odyssey Project with the adults and in Madison, and also with the prisoners. about connecting with them as human beings, about creating a community there, about having them get in touch with their own hunger for learning, their own knowledge, their own ideas. We interviewed Mimi Silbert, who designed and still leads the Delancey Street Project, which is one of the most...
Oh, yes, yes, yes.
Yeah.
That's a wonderful program.
Great program. Yeah, one of the most successful criminal rehabilitation programs in the country.
Yes.
And I asked her what it was that she did that had it work so well, and she said, well, you know, a lot of the liberals will excuse the criminals' behavior because they were raised in bad circumstances. A lot of the conservatives will say, well, put them in prison and have them bust rock. But no one says to them, you have strengths, and we need to help them find their strengths and find the best in themselves, and I think that's what you're doing with your programs.
And you said earlier, Eleanor, that one word can change a life. I saw that happen. There was one inmate who had been really abused by his father. He was white. He was absolutely platinum white, as a matter of fact. And he had been made into a slave. His father had a farm. He had him working in the farm. He had he was fixing cars. He never, ever, ever was told that he did a good job. And until this other staff member in prison told him he had worth. He was a worthwhile human being. And that's all he needed to hear. It changed his life.
Fantastic. Well, that's all the time we have, and I want our listeners to know, if you want to learn more about the work of Jean Faraca here, you can check out her exciting new blog at jeanfaraca.wordpress.com. Jean Faraca, thank you so very much for being on the show today and for your work and helping to change lives.
And thank you, Eleanor, for your work and for this opportunity. I really appreciate it.
Yes, I want you back soon.
Okay.
Thank you.
That's the deal. We've got a date.
Okay, you're on. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye. I have an announcement for our listeners. I'll be doing a day-long program on Creating America the Beautiful on Saturday, September 16th from 9 to 5. We'll focus on what needs to be done to restore democracy in our country, including dealing with dark money and Russian interference in our elections, and also how we personally can strengthen our effectiveness and increase our joy in these turbulent times. For more information and to reserve your space, go to theoracleinstitute.org and look for upcoming events. In case you've missed any of our programs, you'll see them in our archives. If you like this program, please go to iTunes and like it there. Our theme song is Let's Give Them Something to Talk About, sung by Bonnie Raitt. I'll be back next Thursday. Thanks for joining us. This is Eleanor LaCane with All Together Now.